Coach Master Auto Body. Big box store body shops to come to our area. They contract with as many insurance companies as possible. They provide discounts for these referrals. This allows the insurance company to dictate the parts and repair process to ensure the lowest cost of repairs as possible. This is not in your best interest for your expensive investments. At Coachmaster, we work for our customer, not the insurance company. We have no obligation to cut parts prices or use inferior parts. We follow strict manufacturer repair guidelines. It's your choice and your choice alone where you choose to have your vehicle repaired. Coachmaster was established in Reading in 1969 and doing quality repairs in Reading for over 55 years. Coachmaster is proven to be your best choice for collision repair. And yes, it is your choice. Our friendly service and quality repairs will have you referring all your friends and family. And remember, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Remember Coachmaster on Eastside Road. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Regardless of the technologies with which we engage with them as human beings. And we will continue to need students, people in our society who are deeply human and who know how to think well, reason well, live well, who are wise and virtuous.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. David Diener, Assistant Professor of Education here at Hillsdale College. We talk in depth today about the topic of education and technology. Dr. Diener, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Speaking today on the topic of education and technology, let's define a little bit of what we'll be talking about. When we say educational technologies, what do we mean by that phrase?
Well, on the one hand, we mean technologies that are used within the context of education. Things like computers, pencils, et cetera, right? Anything that's used within the classroom or within the school or in educational context. And then I think there's also a question having to do with purpose that has to do with what are ways in which education prepares students for life in a technological world that are important to ask as well.
Why is there such a push today for educational technologies to be used in schools and used in classrooms? Sometimes you even hear schools bragging about, oh, this classroom has smart boards and we're completely linked up to the internet, can do all these things. Why is there a push for those educational technologies in some quarters?
Sure. Interestingly, when we're talking about educational technology in that context, we're usually talking about digital technology. I mean, I jokingly say, you know, pencils are technology.
Sure.
Flush toilets. It's our technology. Electric lights are technology, but we're usually talking about some of the things that you mentioned. So I think there's a cynical answer that's probably partly true, and then there's a more theoretical answer. The cynical answer is this is good money. Okay, so educational tech is a multi-billion dollar industry, and all of the main tech companies, you know, you think of Apple or Google, et cetera, they have whole divisions that are dedicated to quote unquote educational technology. And it's, and again, this is a cynical view, but there is some truth here. They are selling their products in vast numbers, and they are hooking people from a very early age on their products and getting them used to them, which obviously has a long-term benefit. So that's part of the reality, is that a lot of the push for educational technology is coming from people who are very self-interested in this, not from the deeply committed educators who really believe that this is valuable. Okay, that's one answer.
Can these educational technologies that we've described in classrooms form somewhat of a barrier between teacher and students, or even a barrier between student and student?
Absolutely. And I do just want to say, Scott, that there are valuable and good uses for educational technologies. Mm-hmm. So I tend to think and talk more about the problematic aspects, because I think as a society we often miss those. But I certainly don't want to give the perspective that there aren't valuable uses. So that said, yes, these technologies often do form barriers. I think that education and throughout history, education has been understood as a deeply human, intimately human process where you have a teacher and a student or students who are engaging together in this process of exploration, of discovery, of learning. And that's what education is. And so the relationships between teacher and students or between students and students in the community of learners are a very valuable part of the educational process. And what can tend to happen when you start inserting some of these educational technologies in is that the teacher becomes a sort of mere technician or facilitator, mm-hmm. right? And that deeply human connection of a master teacher leading out students on this journey of learning can be lost or in some ways truncated.
So you did say there are some valuable uses. How would you describe a proper role that technological instruction should play in education?
So I think that what's really important is that we ask that question and think about it intentionally. One of the really interesting things that has happened is that as school districts or different sectors add educational technologies, they do it oftentimes almost blind to the actual effects that it has. And there's research that shows this or that, you know, sometimes there are marginal increases. Sometimes the infusion of educational technologies actually decreases certain kinds of student learning. But if you think about this, in what other sector or in what other aspect of education would we say, hey, I've got a great idea. Let's spend $1 billion+ to give, you know, for example, every student in the Los Angeles school system an iPad. Well, is there good data that this $1 billion+ investment is going to have the kind of effect we want? Well, no, but it's really cool. And look at all this stuff we could do. In other words, we unthinkingly assume that there are benefits that sometimes there are, but oftentimes there aren't.
Should the goal of education be informed by the fact that we live in a society driven largely by technology? What about parents who fear that their children will be behind the curve when it comes to using devices or knowing about technology that they might have to use later in life?
It's a great question. The short answer is yes, we should be concerned about it or we should think about it, but it often doesn't yield the answer that I think people assume. So if the goal of education is to form a certain kind of human being, okay, which throughout history has been understood as the purpose of education. Here at Hillsdale College, we are part of that long tradition of classical liberal arts education. So the goal of education is to help to cultivate a person who is able to live well, to live a virtuous and wise life, as an individual and in the context of their family, their civic society, their church, etc. So if you have those deeply human goals, technology in our contemporary age is a part of life. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's relevant to what does it mean to live well. But the answer you give or the way that you think about the role of technology, if you understand the purpose of education that way, is very different than if you think about the purpose of education primarily as technical job training mm-hmm. or something like that. In which case, yes, if you're going to, in 2 years or 4 years or 12 years, depending on the context, if our goal is to prepare you to go out and get job X, then we should be teaching you the technology for job X. If, on the other hand, our primary purpose is to teach you or to help you become a certain kind of human being who interacts with technology well, that is going to lead to different kinds of practical implications in terms of the ways that we will engage with technology.
Talking with Dr. David Diener, he is Assistant Professor of Education at Hillsdale College, about education and technology. Is it possible that when we think about education, the technology provides too many easy answers, meaning that it deters students and others from thinking critically and perhaps preventing key classroom conversations?
Yes. So we know there's great research on this that tech companies don't often publish, but there's a lot of great research that shows that things like, for example, reading comprehension, I'll just use this as an example, are much better when you're holding and reading from a physical book than when you're looking at a screen. When you're holding a physical book, there's a tactile the sense that's involved.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a right hand and a left hand page. Your fingers are feeling that you're at the front or the back of the book or in the middle. There are smells that actually help to embed memories. And so when you're, you know, scrolling across a screen, all of those sort of indicators or hooks are lost. We have lots of great research that reading comprehension and memory recall of what you've read are greater when you've read a physical book than when you've looked at it on a screen. Swiping a screen, surfing the internet, scrolling through with a mouse, these are very low cognitive demand skills. And so what often happens in educational contexts is that some of these technologies are cultivating in students a set of skills which they may need later on, but that precious time within the classroom or at home is being used in a way that is not as impactful educationally as if they were engaging in, let's say, more traditional kinds of educational activities.
Dr. Diener, let's pause right there. Back in a moment with more as we talk education and technology. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history. It is with great honor and pride that we have been able to support several amazing local businesses like these over the years.
Thanks to the Redding Rancheria for their support of the Kiwanis Festa Dam Club Food for Kids program. We send 185 bags of food home every Friday. They're instrumental in helping us.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org, and they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Here at KCNR Radio, we are fortunate to have two well-informed citizens. Hi, I'm Nick Gardner.
And I'm Doug Janke, and we'll give you the inside scoop of news affecting you.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest, Sundays, here, 8 o'clock.
KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and on your AM dial, 1460.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. I'd like to thank everyone who came out for the annual Redding Rancheria Community Fund Dinner. Since its inception in 2002, the fund has granted over $4 million in support of our community.
This year we celebrated organizations who received grants. With your help, we raised over $50,000 for Reading Rancheria Community Fund, helping to continue the cycle of giving. The Reading Rancheria Community Fund Dinner, brought to you by this station and other proud sponsors.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Dr. David Diener, Assistant Professor of Education here at Hillsdale College, about the topic of education and technology. Dr. Diener, I was talking to a history teacher a while ago and discussing the amount of film that's available around World War II, the battles, and I said it must be useful to use that in class. And he said, I'm not sure. I'd like the students to put themselves in those locations, to read, to think about what happened, and to create these images in their mind and put themselves in that place. To that end, educational technologies, do they have an impact on a student's ability to be creative and an ability to imagine?
Yes, and again, just to be clear, those technologies, whether it's films of World War II or whatever the case may be, I think do have a valuable and appropriate role.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that history teacher that you talked to was onto something. And again, think of what happens just in the act of reading. When you're reading something, you are taking the idea or the image that someone else had, the author, that author then translated into this little series of symbols and squiggles on a page. And when you are reading those, you're then decoding that from the squiggles to the words to the meaning of the overall thing. And you are forming in your mind an image. And this is why, or a concept, this is why when you have multiple people read a same text, they might form different images. In other words, cognitively, neurologically, there is creativity that's happening, even in just the very simple act of reading. When you look at a photograph or you watch a video, right, you something like that, those cognitive skills are not required. It's simply presented to your mind. And so the kind of analysis and interpretation doesn't happen. You can't argue discursively with a photograph or a movie. It just is what it is, right? So yeah, it is a different kind of skill. Again, not that it's not valuable in certain contexts, but I think we're selling our students short a lot of times by not requiring as much of them and shaping their minds as we could. And a final comment on this point, again, a lot of work has been done and is being done on neuroplasticity and the way in which the kinds of technologies or engagements educationally that we have, it's not only what's happening right there, it's actually the way in which it wires the brain for future engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So things like attention spans, for example, are quantitatively and demonstrably, measurably being reduced by the kinds of technologies that we're engaging with. Your eyes move differently across a page of text than they do down a computer screen, for example.
Yeah. The classical liberal arts education, the kind that is offered in our Hillsdale K-12 schools, the kind that we talk about and provide to our students here at Hillsdale College, how does a classical liberal arts education, how is it uniquely important in the kind of technological society in which we live?
It's incredibly important because regardless of the technologies with which we engage with them as human beings. And we will continue to need students, people in our society who are deeply human and who know how to think well, reason well, live well, who are wise and virtuous. One of the really interesting things is the way that we're seeing industry leaders within highly technological fields, you know, STEM fields, let's say, call for these deeply human skills. So you have industry leaders saying things like, look, today's college graduates may know all of these computer coding languages, but they don't know how to think.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to work with their colleagues. They don't know how to engage in our company in a meaningful and productive way. They don't know how to write. They don't know how to learn. All they've been taught is this set of technical skills, as though all that the human being is a kind of technological automaton that you can plug in. And so these industry leaders, even in very technological fields, very techie fields, are saying, we need people who have these deeply human abilities that, as you said, a classical liberal arts approach to education, like the one we believe in here at Hillsdale College, are cultivating. And then you can learn those technological skills. You know, another way of thinking of this, when I was a headmaster of K-12 schools, I would always ask parents when they would ask this question about, you know, what kind of technologies do you use in the classrooms? And I was basically say, well, lights and pencils and books, you know, those are all technologies. But think about this. When your five-year-old child is graduating from high school or graduating from college or in their 50s making a career change, right? Is the iPad going to be the thing that they really need in order to be successful? Or pick whatever, you know, gadget du jour you want. And so a school system that says, oh, look, we're preparing your five-year-old for this technological society by giving them a Chromebook or whatever the current technology of today is completely missing the point that in 10, 20, 50 years, those technologies are going to be radically different. What we need is people who know how to think about technology, who know how to learn, who have the communication skills, the thinking skills, the learning skills that will enable them to adapt and thrive within those technological contexts. And so ironically, I would argue the best way to prepare students for life in a technological age is precisely by focusing on those deeply human things and not spending so much time on the specific technological devices of today.
Final question for Dr. David Diener as we talk about education and technology. Do you see a pushback on some of these technologies or the uses of these technologies in classrooms, specifically in a post-COVID world in which parents got a look at how perhaps Zoom teaching was working for their children? Is that a healthy reaction to what we saw during the COVID years of education?
I think in many ways COVID showed people, well, it showed parents what their students were or were not being taught. But I do think it also showed people that a kind of purely technological medium of education loses certain deeply human aspects that we actually really care about. And so it was a kind of test case where I think a lot of people saw, oh, wait a minute, my 16-year-old sitting on their bed for days at a time staring at a screen is not actually great education, beyond just a question of is the program working well or some of these technical things. So yes, I think that's a very valuable thing. Also, the emergence of artificial intelligence is raising some of these questions as well.
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute, hold on. You know, we like using technology, but artificial intelligence has the potential to, in many ways, undermine the educational process by allowing students to simply generate things that they're not thinking about or producing at all. So it raises these deep questions that I think we as a society need to consider carefully.
Dr. David Diener, Assistant Professor of Education at Hillsdale College, as we talk about education and technology. Dr. Diener, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, Jeffrey E. Paul, his brand new book, Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From, and How to Defeat It. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Transfer options to four-year universities,
highlighting how Shasta College's transfer guarantees with all the California State Universities and six of the Universities of California. That's Tuesday, March 26th via Zoom, 6 to 7 p.m. Learn more about how your student can save money and time by transferring from Shasta College. For questions, call Enrollment Services at 530-242-7790 or go to shastacollege.edu.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Hi, I'm Adam Ryan, presiding judge of the Shasta County Superior Court. The Superior Court is now accepting applications from those individuals that are interested in serving on the Shasta County Grand Jury. To apply or get more information, please visit our website at ShastaCountyGrandJury.org.
Interested? Please come to the informational meeting for a thorough presentation with a question and answer period. Wednesday, March 27th at 3 p.m. at the Reading City Hall Community Room.
Please apply now.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel has a full-service organization with departments staffed with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Susan Eastman, financial advisor, Stifel Nicolaus. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Give me a call at 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. Find older episodes of this program and all sorts of Hillsdale College audio. We're joined by Jeffrey Paul. He's a research professor in the Social Philosophy and Policy Center of the John Chambers College of Business and Economics at West Virginia University. And his recent book is Winning America's Second Civil War: Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From, and How to Defeat It. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
Before we dig into the book, let's give you the opportunity to explain the title, America's Second Civil War. How do you identify that? How do you describe it?
I describe it in the following way. The first Civil War was over the founding principles. The founding principles were that every human being has a natural right by virtue of his or her nature to self-ownership, liberty, and the fruits of their labor. What happened was a second civil war began about a little over a decade after the first. What most of us would have thought was that that first Civil War would have resolved the question of whether individuals had natural rights or not, because the North prevailed, and that was the central principle, the founding, of course. What happened was, after that, the college and university presidents in the United States from the top colleges decided that they wanted graduate programs, and they used as their model the German universities, which it had been granting doctoral degrees since for about 200 years at that point. And what they wanted to do was to import either Germans or Americans trained in Germany with doctorates to populate the universities and colleges so that they could give genuine doctoral programs in their various disciplines that would be the equal of the German universities. And that worked in a profound way in the natural sciences and medicine. In the social sciences and humanities, it was something of a disaster. Mm-hmm. Because the German views were allied with those of the Confederacy. That is, human beings had no natural rights. Human beings were the cellular parts of an organism called the state or the nation. And in being parts of an organism, their duty was to keep the organism going and to take orders from the brain to do their duty to sustain the organism. They had no rights, according to this view. In order to disguise what their views were to the outside world, the world outside of the academy, and so they had to rename themselves, and they renamed themselves by inventing a term borrowed from the German Progress Party, and they call themselves progressives.
So they have a term and a phrase. How do they explain that word to other Americans?
They explain themselves as being progressives because what they believed is that history had a positive evolution and it will always go in one trajectory, and that people like themselves, their job as intellectuals was to identify the tendency which would most favor most humanities, the historical tendency, and then try to implement that tendency in the countries that they occupied. That's how they characterized themselves. But what they kept fairly disguised until, I would say, the turn of the century to the 20th century, was that they were total opponents of natural rights. They didn't believe humans had them, and so on. So they became as virulent opponents of the founding principles identified by Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence as the Confederacy. And their teachers in Germany, these Americans who came back, were admirers of the Confederacy. They were autocratic, anti-Semitic, and generally racist. And so with the influence of the professors, the people who were being educated in universities, who were few in the 19th century, but were many in the 20th century, were educated as they would have been in Germany and would have assimilated the same political principles in the United States that they had assimilated in Germany. And then I'll try to end this at this point. What happened was progressivism began to make its way into politics. That's basically, in a nutshell, what the book is about. The question is whether we have reached the point in which we are really in. We know there's been a preface to a second civil war. The question is whether we are now in such a war in which these two views confront one another, and only one of them can prevail in the long run.
Talking with Jeffrey Paul, his book, Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From and How to Defeat It. So a couple of questions from inside the book. You quote Charles Beard saying something, I'm paraphrasing a bit, the Constitution, the argument of those progressives, the Constitution was not written to protect alleged natural rights. So the question is, what, from their perspective, why was it written? What caused it to be written? What motivated the authors in their mind?
What motivated the authors in their minds were they sought to protect their property. They were so motivated, and then they invented natural rights as justification. It was simply a justification to satisfy their economic appetites. That was the view. And the view wasn't they came from, these rights come from the nature of human beings or come from God. The view was that they were motivated and had to have a pretext, a philosophical pretext. That was their view.
Jeffrey Paul with us. Winning America's Second Civil War is his recent book. Later on, you say that at present, the most dangerous pretext for depriving Americans of natural rights is universal free health care. Why is that most dangerous?
It's a danger because it cedes to the government a monopoly on health care. And those sorts of monopolies make individuals completely dependent for their health care on a government provision. And with that sort of monopoly, not only is it less available, it's medical services, are they less available, but frequently they are not permitted. And we know of cases in England, a lot of cases in England, I cite a couple to illustrate. In the case of children, they get a disease if the authorities in England say that their condition cannot be improved medically, but there are people in the United States or in other places that say, yes, it can be treated, they will not permit the parents to take the kid out of the hospital in England and take him to the United States or elsewhere. And that's the kind of danger centrally controlled and monopolized healthcare presents to the average person.
Jeffrey E. Paul, hold on. We'll come back and talk about the income tax in America, how that started, and what could be changed. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Dr. Eric and Tiffany Blasengame present Amazing Pollinators, on display now through May 27th at the Turtle Bay Museum. Immerse yourself in this visually stunning, game-based role-play adventure that explores the colorful and diverse world of pollinator and plant relationships. Amazing Pollinators at Turtle Bay Museum was created by Minotaur Mazes, a company specializing in interactive maze exhibits. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Do you or someone you love struggle with PTSD, anxiety, depression, insomnia, OCD, alcoholism, substance abuse disorder, autism, ADHD, brain fog, or traumatic brain injury? At Shasta Meadows Wellness Center, Dr. Taggart and his team offer safe, proven, and effective care, even for those resistant to typical medicine. Learn more about Shasta Meadows Wellness Center. They have IV ketamine or at-home oral ketamine. Ask about the state-of-the-art EEG guided TMS therapy. This customized, safe, no side effect option is effective on a wide range of difficult to treat conditions. Visit us today at ShastaMeadowsWellness.com. Don't just get by, Get well.
Call to make an appointment for a free consultation. 530-444-8304. 530-444-8304. Shasta Meadows Wellness Center in Reading.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Experience for the first time glowing wild an illuminated wildlife lantern display at Turtle Bay's McConnell Botanical Gardens at the Sundial Bridge in Redding, California. Open select dates March 29th through May 26, 2024. Year of the Dragon. Glowing Wild will feature 10 acres of botanical gardens filled with larger-than-life Asian lantern displays of animals from around the world, plus music, animation, food and drinks, and more. Don't miss Glowing Wild at Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Jeffrey E. Paul. His new book, Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From, and How to Defeat It. Dr. Paul, I want to ask this because it will come back up when we talk about your solutions at the end of the book. That is, how did this type of ideology lead to income taxation without limitation, as you write in the book?
Well, what happened was the first generation, the two institutions that the first generation took over immediately, and I'm talking about only in the social sciences and the humanities, were Columbia and Johns Hopkins, which mm-hmm. was founded in 1876. And these institutions had people in a variety of the social science disciplines. And at Columbia, the first person with a doctorate in economics was a man named E.R.A. Seligman.
Before we get there, can you give us a little bit of a refresher course, a background on the history of the income tax here in the United States?
Taxation in the United States in the 19th century basically was what emanated from the natural rights view. In other words, natural rights include the right to property, the right to things you produce. And what the government is supposed to do, it's supposed to be highly limited to protecting these rights, the right to life, the right to liberty, and the right to property. If it's supposed to protect your life and your property, then what follows is that taxes, which must be raised to support the activity, the legitimate activity of the government, should accord with what they're protecting. So basically, just as you're charged, just as you get insurance for a house and the insurance, the amount of insurance that you pay, is correlated with the value of your house, so taxes should be correlated with the value of your assets. Therefore, in the 19th century, taxation at the state level, and the states, you have to realize, were raising sometimes more, but then sometimes only slightly less than the federal government. Their taxes were as substantial as those of the federal government. Taxation was supposed to be a tax on net worth. They called it the general property tax. Every state had its own, but basically what they were was a tax on net worth. because that's what was being protected, a proportional tax on net worth, not a progressive one on net worth. Mm-hmm. As a federal government, the only taxes were taxes on sales. Most of them were tariffs. They raised the most amount of money. There were also sin taxes, but they were taxes on sales.
Dr. Jeffrey Paul with us. When then does that begin to change? When does income begin to play a role in this taxation?
The first one in the United States was levied to fund the Civil War. The income tax was instituted in 1861 and ran up till 1872, and there was complete opposition to it after the war was over and finally terminated in 1872. Second income tax was levied in 1894, and that one was found to be unconstitutional. Therefore, the Constitution had to be amended. ERA Seligman at Columbia provided the principal arguments for that tax. And the arguments were extremely shoddy. That's all I can say. They were really a series of assertions. And Seligman argued that there wasn't any natural rights to property. Very odd for him, since he was the son of a very wealthy man. And taxes, therefore, should raise money not based on the benefit that the individual receives in protecting his property, but based instead on the needs of society. And that meant that taxes should accord with one's financial capabilities. Now, that would imply a net worth tax also, but he skips over that. He criticizes the practicality of having a net worth tax, stressing various problems that the states had or others had with them, and therefore he proposed a progressive income tax. And he and a number of political forces within the country pressed forward with that, and it was proposed in 1909, and then finally passed in 1913. So it wasn't derived by asking what accords with the natural rights that human beings have. He rejected natural rights absolutely, as did all the first generation of the progressives who had had training in Germany.
And then you described the most important and far-reaching reform possible is taxation at the federal level. Your proposal would repeal all sorts of personal and corporate income taxes and instead install a universal 1.13% sales tax that would be included even on sales of stocks, bonds, and derivatives. That's where a majority of the revenue would be raised. Walk us through that just briefly about how that would work and why it would work.
Well, it would work because, as I explained in my book, we had economists reviewing, ultimately we reviewed the years between 2011 and 2021, about 10 years. And what we found in each of those years, that tax would exceed in revenue all of the federal planned expenditures, the budget, for each one of those years. 91% of the revenues would come from the sale of stocks and bonds. The advantage to the individual is, even if one is trading in stocks and bonds and derivatives, when one sells what one has purchased including the 1.13 sales tax, there is no capital gains tax. One of the possible criticisms of this system is that it might retard activity on the stock exchange and they might migrate to other exchanges. The advantage of being on the stock exchange after this universal sales tax is enacted is that while it costs you a little over 1% to buy something, you pay no taxes on the sale of it. So it's as if it was in a retirement account or other non-taxable account under the present system. And our view is that it's unlikely that people would make their purchases elsewhere, because if they did, they would not receive the benefit of a zero capital gains tax when they realized a profit on the sale of a financial asset. And in fact, we started off with the year 2019, and what we found in 2019, using the budget that was used there, that it would have balanced that budget and that it would have exceeded it considerably.
More on that in Jeffrey Paul's new book, Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From, and How to Defeat It. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. David Diener from Hillsdale's Education Department and Jeffrey E. Paul, his new book, Winning America's Second Civil War. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcasts.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the program is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Experience luxurious bliss with Pinnacle Cultivators, Redding's premier licensed legacy cultivator, exclusively at the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake. Pinnacle's carefully crafted, expertly curated flower guarantees an exceptional experience with rare genetics and distinctive flavors, freshly packaged daily for a genuine farm-to-table experience. Visit 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-276-9771 for delivery and hours of operation. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us. What shall we
do about them? The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.